You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
First Nations listeners are advised that the following program may contain the names and voices of our mob who have passed on to the dreaming. Hello, listeners. This is Kieran Stewart Asherton, and you're listening to Yilliman on 3CR. 3cr.org.au, streamed online and via the playback service. You can also listen on your radio, 855 AM on your dial. And you can listen back on demand wherever you listen to your podcast, Spotify, iTunes, whatever else. So today, I'm going to be talking about a bit of an old issue. I'm sorry to drag it back up again, but, you know, unfortunately it's something that people are still talking about and still haven't got their head around. I'm talking about the Voice to Parliament referendum here. So we're now nearly 2 years on from that failed referendum, but I'm still seeing quite a lot of discourse around it, and a lot of the discourse is very pro-voice. Now, if you're new to this discussion, if you're living under a rock back in 2023, geez, 2013, but you know, this is the thing, we're going to talk about this today, this actually does go back decades, but you know, if you're living under a rock at the time and you thought that this was some progressive agenda by Labor, we're going to talk about why you're wrong today, because there is still so many people out there, whether they be tokenuts or whether they be, you know, so-called progressives, who are still banging on about the Voice to Parliament as if it was a good thing. It wasn't. So we're going to be unpacking a bit of that today. Now, to do this, I'm going to rely on a bunch of different things, but in particular, I want to read out an article that myself and some other comrades in the BPU authored back in the lead-up to the referendum back in 2023. I also want to read out an article. I'm not sure that it was ever published, but the BPU's secretary, Jasper, has about a year ago written this really great article a year on from the referendum. And I wanted to read that out as well, because there's some really great information in here. Now, I promise not to bore you for too long reading out these articles in a, you know, monotone voice. I'll try and make it as engaging as I can. And afterwards, I'm going to be having a bit of a talk about it as well. But yeah, I might as well just get straight into it. So to start off with, I'm going to start off reading this BPU article. Now, if you wanted to go and read it yourself, you can find it on the BPU's website, blackpeoplesunion.org. And you can also find it on Crikey, where it was published as well. We often hear from Yes supporters that they despair at the thought of waking up in an Australia where the no vote has been successful. These so-called progressives are desperate to ignore the inconvenient truth of both no campaigns, which is that they reflect the reality of the Australian colony far more than the Yes campaign could ever hope to. The racist no embodies the reality of the settler colony and reflects the ideological foundation and spirit of the Australian nation. It highlights the deeply vicious anti-Indigenous sentiment that resides at the core of the Australian national identity. To be Australian is to accept the narrative about us as dispossessed and defeated people, as bongs, petrol sniffers and dole bludgers, in need of care and control by the white man who knows best. It is to want to eradicate us, whether that be by extermination or assimilation. This is the reality that Yes campaigners refuse to reckon with. The reality too many mob live with every single day. A colony that kills us, that steals our children, that destroys our land, that poisons our water, blows up our sacred sites, throws us in prison, and tells us that we are the problem. It is a nation that tells us we do not belong on our own land. The Progressive No campaign embodies the spirit of revolutionary justice by demanding that we confront the history of the Australian nation. The Yes campaigners will do well to remember that this is a history that has never been reckoned with in any meaningful way. We do not want to be recognised by the colonial constitution. We do not want to be part of it at all. Those who say that this inclusion would be a meaningful step Do not speak for us. We do not want reconciliation. We want a reckoning. When we say that First Nations sovereignty was never ceded, we do not simply mean that our spiritual sovereignty remains intact regardless of the colony's existence. We mean that we maintain our legitimate claim to the lands and resources of this continent and the right to determine our own lives and future, and we do not recognise the sovereignty of the illegal invader. We view the Colonial Federation as an occupying force whose existence to this day is predicated on the ongoing theft of our lands and the genocide of our people. Sovereignty is both our right to our lands and resources and our own self-determinant governance structures, and First Nations people have not ceded our sovereignty. The Yes campaign is living in an illusion where Australia is a progressive nation, where unity can be found through democratic participation and racism can be addressed through voting. Some of the Yes campaigners attempt to justify a reluctant or coerced position by claiming that they are seeking to avoid future harm and promote inclusion. All too often, it is those who are not at risk of harm preaching harm reduction, those who aren't starving telling us to take the scraps that we are offered. Labor, Noel Pearson, Marsha Langton, and their gang of bullies would have us all believe that this is Australia's one chance to give First Nations people a step towards progress. To be told that our only chance of receiving any sort of help must come in a regressive, conservative measure is nothing short of blackmail. The progressive veneer belies a sinister reality, which is that the campaign is funded by mining giants and stacked with LNP affiliates. The voice body itself will be utterly powerless, with the ability to advise only, and on just a handful of issues. Right now, any single individual or any organisation can submit a representation to Parliament on any single agenda. But the voice body won't even be able to do this, because they'll only be able to submit representations on specific issues the government allows them to. It will have less power than any individual on the streets right now. And we are supposed to risk the threat to our sovereignty for this? We are supposed to consent to being recognised by the very entity that destroys us in order to exist? We're supposed to be grateful? Some people claim that the call for constitutional recognition is the culmination of decades of hard work and struggle by Aboriginal people. They often reference the 1995 ATSIC report to Keating on native title social justice measures that recommended constitutional recognition. This is deceptive because the report called for sweeping social justice reforms, and recognition was only one part of a wider range of recommendations, and even then only had partial support from First Nations people. It is misleading to extract constitutional recognition from the ATSIC report and claim that this is what First Nations people have been asking for, because this reform was meant to be part of wider reforms that conferred much more power and control to First Nations people over our land and our affairs. Constitutional recognition was meant to enshrine the rights derived from these grand reforms that were being proposed: treaty, land rights, and self-governance. This idea being promoted today that First Nations people have been calling for constitutional recognition since back then is not accurate. We know that because we know the history of the political movement was always about land rights, treaty, and self-determination. Political struggles are not fought over symbolic gestures. Our people did not fight and struggle so long for constitutional recognition, and certainly not for a form of it that confers us no authority over our own lives or our land. What is on offer today is not the combination of our ancestors' struggles. Our people called for land rights, treaty, and enshrined political, social, and economic rights. We did not call for recognition alone, and when we did call for recognition, it was purely to enshrine substantive, enforceable rights. This entire aspect of our struggle has been ignored and swept under the rug. None of these demands have ever been implemented. Instead, we have been offered symbolism and a powerless advisory body. The idea of constitutional recognition has had bipartisan support since its inception, and although its current iteration did not gain any traction until John Howard's 2007 proposal, we can see in the 1990s that there were already two emerging distinct concepts of what recognition meant. It seems that Howard's concept has prevailed, because that is what is on offer today, a symbolic gesture void of any practical power in any sense whatsoever. The distinction is clear and apparent. You have symbolic constitutional recognition on the one hand, which is what has political presence today. Then, on the other hand, you have the idea of constitutional recognition of substantial rights and powers, as proposed in the ATSIC report. And that was what was supported by some mob in the 90s. It was still conservative in the sense that it proposed to reform the colonial law, but it was a major reform of the Constitution by enshrining rights for First Nations people, and it's substantial in comparison to what is being proposed today. The two things are very different, and we must be clear about that. Being recognised could make absolutely no difference to our lives whatsoever, or it could make an enormous difference. The BPU does not endorse or support constitutional recognition, but it does support free, prior, and informed consent for our people when voting on our political future. If we are being told that we only have one shot to amend the Constitution to recognise us, then right now we have opted for the weakest form of recognition that gives us the least amount of power and protection. There are yes campaigners telling us that this is self-determination. Self-determination means control over our own social, political, and economic affairs. This proposal is not the self-determination asked for in the ATSIC report, nor our land rights movements, nor at the regional dialogues, nor in the dictionary definition. It does not allow us to determine our own affairs, only to advise on them. There has always been a soft and a radical approach to Indigenous politics, but if you really look at the history of the movement, the Tent Embassy, the land rights movement, the refusal to cede sovereignty, this is the mainstay of our political movement. Our movement has never been about reform. Treaty was what we were talking about in the 1980s. It still was in the 90s, and then we had Mabo. This is where a split really emerged. We have people like Noel Pearson, Sol Bellar, and Marsha Langton rallying behind John Howard's native title legislation, and then we have people like Gary Foley, Chick Addiction, and Michael Mansell, who are always critical of native title and its divide and conquer impact on our people. There were the radicals who opposed it, and then there were those who supported it, an emerging class of First Nations people who were close to government and took the softer approach of reform, foregoing the concrete demands of economic rights and land rights that characterised our struggle. This is where constitutional recognition is situated, within the reconciliation era. The soft approach orchestrated by the Pearsons and Langtons that call for us to unify and assimilate into the colony. This is what we are seeing play out today, and in the same way that native title was a devastating attack on the land rights movements, constitutional recognition will be yet another attack on our struggle for our land and our self-determination. The colony is telling us what our place is. The only land rights they will give us is native title, and the only self-determination they will allow are powerless advisory bodies and symbolic recognition in their constitution. So, what is the Uluru Statement from the Heart? The answer to this begins back in 2015, when then Liberal National Party Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull established the Referendum Council, a collective of hand-selected First Nations people sitting alongside former LNP ministers and staffers, joined by a small handful of Labor ministers responsible for selling off public assets, and executives from mining and energy conglomerates. This referendum council was tasked with talking to Australians about changing our constitution to recognise our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. In the lead-up to the Yallara Convention, 12 regional dialogues, and one information day were held across the continent. This consultation is boasted as being the most in-depth consultation of First Nations people to have ever taken place. The sad reality, however, is that the greatest consultation to have ever taken place involved 0.1% of our population from only a mere 12 of our 250-plus individual nations. A document released earlier in the year 2023 as a result of an FOI request shows what First Nations people asked for at these regional dialogues. They asked for designated seats in Parliament, tangible land rights, self-determination, and treaty. No one had asked for a powerless voice to Parliament to be enshrined in the Constitution, and where there were mentions of a parliamentary body, it was specifically stated each time that it would need to have more than just advisory capabilities, and instead would need to have the power for First Nations people to introduce their own legislation and amendments and veto proposals that could negatively impact First Nations lands and communities. The Referendum Council then held the Yallara Convention, where they deliberately excluded many prominent and dedicated activists, leaders, and campaigners from attending. Despite the exclusions, many of the people at the Yallara Convention still walked out in protest at the way the convention was being held. Specifically, that First Nations people present didn't actually get any input on the wording of the Uluru Statement and instead had to choose between taking what was being offered by the Referendum Council or having nothing at all. Those that chose to stay and sign the Uluru Statement signed a blank canvas that was filled in later by the Referendum Council with emotive language that has no real material cause for progress or empowerment, just constitutional recognition wrapped up in a pretty package. Now, to fully understand why the government's push for constitutional recognition came about in the first place, we need to go back to the early 1990s. The Aboriginal Land Rights Campaign was a strong and successful political movement. It had gained traction and widening public support in the 80s, and it gained even more power in the 90s with the 1992 Mabo decision, which exposed the legal fiction of terra nullius. Sovereignty, land rights, compensation and justice were all at the forefront of both First Nations and the Australian public's consciousness, and for the colonial government, that was dangerous. So what was needed to rein in these threats to the colony? Firstly, the Australian government introduced the concept of reconciliation. Let's just all get along. Unity is the most important thing above all. Then, in 1993, they introduced the Native Title Act, the weakest form of land rights in a Western legal system. These two bones were thrown to First Nations people and effectively drained all of the radical and revolutionary energy from the land rights movement, sucking it into the damaging and lengthy legal processes of making a native title claim. In 1999, John Howard first supported the proposal for a preamble in the Constitution to recognise First Nations people. And then, in 2007, after instituting the Northern Territory intervention, John Howard put forward the proposal himself that the colonial government would recognise First Nations people in their constitution. These events, intervention and recognition, indicate, apparently, two polar opposites in intention. One, on the face of it, is an apartheid-style military occupation of First Nations communities. The other, on the face of it, sounds progressive and is framed by the government as a gift for Aboriginal people. Putting forth the idea of constitutional recognition at this time was not merely a sinister, cynical ploy to divert attention away from the crimes being committed against First Nations people under the intervention, although it was that too. It was also a further step in the conservative efforts to rein in what had been a strong and successful political movement. Constitutional recognition has bipartisan political support because ultimately it benefits the colony and only the colony. Constitutional recognition is not a First Nations idea, just like native title and reconciliation are not First Nations ideas. These are three hugely significant instances of non-Indigenous ideas taking up the entire room of Indigenous political struggle, supplanting the land rights movement and diverting energy into the native title claims process. Reconciliation softens the strength and potency of the land rights and sovereignty claims by diverting attention to vague notions of unity and incrementalism. Constitutional recognition may not have made any traction in 2007, but its genesis was in a conservative reaction against the land rights movement, and in that context, its ultimate goal can be seen. It is not a vehicle for progressing First Nations rights. It is a vehicle for halting them. The reality is Australia does not exist. It is an illusion. A handful of American and British companies in a trench coat. This government commits some of the worst human rights abuses in the world against our very own people and against those seeking refuge at our land shores. In fact, it would be fair to say that Australia is one of the most racist, classist, and immoral developed nations in the world. Don't believe us? Go and compare any social or health statistic for mob with any other group anywhere else in the world. First Nations people suffer under some of the world's worst conditions. Highest incarceration and deaths in custody rates, highest rates of several chronic illnesses, SIDS, and suicide, highest missing and murdered women and children rates, and the highest rate of homelessness, just to name a few. Australia is home to the largest racial genocide in known history, where 98% of not just a culture or a religious group, but 98% of an entire race was slaughtered. And Australia still denies the allegation of genocide while trying to force us into their constitution. Australia's recent history includes a massacre in the 1970s, atomic bomb testing on First Nations communities alongside the US in the 60s, and racial slavery as recent as 45 years ago, long after the US abolished it. The country still disproportionately targets First Nations people in the criminal and family courts. Politicians prioritise spending on corporate bailouts and military ventures while scrutinising us for a predicament they not only put us in, but keep us in. And thanks to a corporate monopoly owning the newspapers, TV stations, radio stations, and other mainstream media, the vast majority of Australians are completely oblivious to their own nation's backyard, content in their lucky country. The Constitution is not a progressive document, and this state is not a progressive nation that we can be proud to be included in. Voting yes to a proposal that First Nations people have already said no to three times will do nothing to reckon with the racist and violent reality of Australia. The British landed on these shores 235 years ago, and the colonies, states federated into the modern nation of Australia 122 years ago. As it does in every nation, the time has come for so-called Australia to mature and reckon with its history and the reality of what it is today. This is not going to happen if a yes vote gets up, and we spend the next 2 years having a public debate about the form and substance of the voice body. It is not going to happen through representatives in government buildings, NGOs and corporations deciding what is best for us. We, as First Nations people, have already been subject to abuse and vilification throughout the referendum campaign. Until we have substantially addressed the racism that lies at the core of this nation, it is irresponsible to throw us under the bus in a culture war for a powerless body and recognition that we don't want. Yes campaigners are dreaming if they think a no vote is going to embolden racism. We are already given too much, according to racists, so we are sure you can imagine the outrage that awaits us if First Nations people are given our very own constitutional voice in modern-day colonial Australia, a nation where Nazis can openly seek hail on the steps of Parliament under police protection, and where First Nations children are still run down in cars driven by grown men. The reality is, A no vote won't change the way things are, but it will force the Yes campaign and its supporters to reckon with the Australia, with the reality that Australia isn't ready for this kind of change, and that serious steps need to be taken before any kind of legal action concerning the political future of First Nations people is attempted again. So, what should we do when we wake up in Australia where the no vote has won? We should continue to voice our demands for self-determination, and we should continue building a mass movement to help us enforce them. The reality is that First Nations people can never place our liberation into the hands of our oppressors, the colonial government. We will never be given an option to vote our way to freedom. The very survival of the colony depends on the continued exploitation and oppression of our people and our lands. As a start, we need to demand truth-telling across this continent. We need an end to the theft of our babies and the locking away of our children. We need to stop the murder of our people at the hands of police and lynch mobs, and we need to take police guns out of our communities. We need to eradicate poverty, illiteracy, and poor health from our people's reality. We need to demand reparations for slavery and stolen wages, and ultimately, we need to take back the land and natural resources that are rightfully ours. These are things that can only be achieved through a pan-Aboriginal movement with our allies by our side, where we have enough strength as a united political force to effect real change. The government bodies, NGOs and corporations that have been working to reduce the gap in statistical outcomes for First Nations people have a lot to answer for, as that gap has only widened each year while their pockets have grown fatter. We must call this betrayal out for what it is. We cannot place our faith or our future in the hands of a neoliberal colony whose every aspect and function reproduces the conditions for our oppression and destruction. As for the rest of Australia, there is a reckoning with the truth that needs to occur before First Nations people are ever asked to risk our sovereignty again. There is a sickness and a trauma that lies at the heart of the Australian nation. This wound needs to be addressed and reparations need to be made. To those who consider voting yes to be a progressive stance, we hope that you consider our analysis in good faith and come to see the voice as the meaningless, regressive consolation prize that it is. Because our bottom line is this: we will no longer accept poisonous scraps and feel-good platitudes from the colony, and we will no longer tolerate fear of the truth. Australians must reckon with the reality that this continent is our sovereign land and it has not been ceded. That was an article that was released in Crikey and is up on the BPU's website. That article came out in the lead up to the Voice to Parliament referendum 2 years ago now. And we're talking about this again today because, unfortunately, even though we're 2 years on, even though all of this information has come to light and there's been all these facts and all this misinformation debunked and whatever else, we still see so many so-called progressives and so-called allies still banging on about the Voice to Parliament as if it was a good thing. It wasn't. It was a horrible thing. It was a assimilation agenda aimed at eroding our sovereignty and assimilating us into the Australian colony. That's what it was. And it was also something that was very much, I don't think I actually mentioned it in the article anywhere, but it was something that was co-authored by Mark Liebler, who, you know, if you might know the name, if you don't, Mark Liebler was, for 10 years, the chair of the Zionist Federation of Australia and is currently the chair of the Australia-Israel Jewish Affairs Committee. Mark Liebler is a hardcore Zionist. He is a full-on hardcore right-wing conservative Zionist. And he does quite a lot of these, little assimilation tactics on mob. He's been doing it for many years now. And, you know, we need only to look at places like Palestine to know that Zionists are not the friends of indigenous people. Zionists are colonizers. Zionism is a colonial political ideology. Now, why would somebody like Mark Liebler, who was the co-chair of the referendum council, by the way, why would somebody like Mark Liebler actually support First Nations liberation? The answer is he wouldn't. He would not. He would support our continued occupation, our colonization, and our assimilation. Now, I'm going to play some music. I've just spoke for the last half an hour. I'll play a song or two, and then I'll be right back to talk a bit more about this. Up next, though, I'm going to be looking at an article from BPU Secretary Jasper that was written about a year ago now as a 12-month follow-up to the failed Voice to Parliament referendum.
You're listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned to hear the rest of your 3CR podcast.
You're listening to 3CR, 855 AM on your dial, 3cr.org.au, streamed online and via the playback service. You can also listen in a bunch of other places, such as Spotify, iTunes, the Community Radio app, and wherever else you might get your podcasts. You just heard a song that was Assimilate by Omar Musa and Tasman Keefe, a very fitting song given the topics that we're discussing today. And then in that sound cut there, straight after the song, you might have heard about how Australia jails Aboriginal people at five times the rate of apartheid South Africa. Now, when I first heard that statistic, I was a bit like, wow, you know, like, not surprised, but, you know, I wanted to go look that up a bit more myself. And do you know what I actually found? Australia doesn't jail Aboriginal people at five times the rate of South Africa during the apartheid period. It's actually 6.8 times the rate. It's nearly seven times the rate. Blackfellas here in this colony are locked up at nearly seven times the rate that black African people in South Africa were locked up at the height of apartheid. That is an absolutely disgusting situation and disgusting statistic, but this is a very disgusting colony, so it's to be expected, I suppose. And, you know, in line with the disgustingness of this colony, today we're talking about the Voice to Parliament referendum from 2 years ago. We're talking about this because we're still seeing quite a lot of, you know, so-called progressives and so-called allies out here banging on about the Voice to Parliament still and talking about it as if it was a good thing, as if it was, you know, a gift for us from the Australian Labor Party. When the reality is the Voice to Parliament and constitutional recognition always has been a conservative agenda. Now, I spoke a bit in the first half of the show about the history leading up to the Voice to Parliament. In particular, I read a article from the BPU and from Crikey that was put out in the lead up to the Voice to Parliament referendum. You can go and read that article yourself. If you Google Conning Us Into Recognition, that was the name of the article, or you can just head to the BPU's website, blackpeoplesunion.org, and you'll find it there. Another really great resource, though, that I recommend people who are interested in any of this stuff, or interested in the history of Aboriginal political struggle here, and the way that the Australian government and the Business Council has consistently attacked our struggles, a really great book is called Driving Disunity, The Business Council Against Aboriginal Community. Now, that book was written by Lindy Nolan from the Spirit of Eureka website and publication, as well as the CPAML. It's a really, really great resource, that book. It's not a very big book. It's not very long. But it really documents and highlights the way that the Australian Business Council has consistently attacked First Nations struggles and First Nations liberation, how they've consistently, you know, pushed this rhetoric around stuff like reconciliation and, you know, constitutional recognition and all this other garbage that has been pushed by them. So it's a really great book in my opinion, and I recommend that you go and get yourself a copy of that book and have a quick read. As I said, it's not a very big book. It's only a few dozen pages, I think. It'll be less than 100 pages, I'm sure. But yeah, it's a quick read, but it's really factual, has a great timeline in it. So go and get yourself a copy of that book. Now, we've got about 20 minutes left on the show. I wanted to read out this article that BPU Secretary Jasper wrote about a year ago, in the lead up to the, you know, year anniversary after the failed voice to parliament referendum. I'm just going to read it out instead of blabbing on about it. Although the voice proposition was heralded as a Labour policy, it has truly been a political football between both major parties for decades under the guidance of Mark Liebler. Constitution recognition has its roots in the 1990s. Constitutional recognition was first proposed by a BHP bulletin, known at the time as Western Mining Corp. It was first proposed as a tool to circumvent First Nations claims to sovereignty, and with it, our rights to our lands and natural resources. The iteration that was voted on was co-designed by people like Mark Liebler, former president of the Zionist Federation of Australia and national chairman of Australia, Israel and Jewish Affairs Council, as well as former Howard staffers and ministers like Mark Texter, Tony Nutt and Amanda Vanstone. Additionally, Liebler was a founding member of Reconciliation Australia and co-chaired the Referendum Council Constitutional Recognition of Indigenous Australians, culminating at the Uluru Dialogue. In 2010, the federal government formed an expert panel on constitutional recognition, co-chaired by Mark Liebler and Pat Dobson. This was initially handed to Julia Gillard and kicked down the road until the Recognition Act was passed in 2013. In 2015, Malcolm Turnbull selected the members of the Referendum Council alongside Bill Shorten, who would then, after 5 years of federal legislation, ask for the opinions of hand-selected members of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander community. After the political football was handballed between members of the major parties, the proposal led by Mark Liebler culminated in the Uluru Statement from the Heart, a statement that the masses were told was a generous offer from the Indigenous community to Australia. But that couldn't be further from the truth. We say that the proposition was implied consent for a people that had no say. Architects of the proposal, Noel Pearson and Marshall Langton, represent the ultra-conservative infiltration of the Aboriginal movement. Both of them were vocal supporters of the horrible 2007 Northern Territory intervention that terrorised our communities. These two figures have been long-standing, controversial figures representing right-wing Aboriginal nationalism. In November 2023, Langton criticised the flying of the Aboriginal and Palestinian flags together, stating, "No legitimate Aboriginal will permit our movement to be associated with terrorists," end quote. Except that couldn't be further from the case. It is our staunchest resistance fighters who have stood proudly, shoulder to shoulder, with our Palestinian comrades. Langton explicitly condemned the Black Sovereign Movement for our support of the Palestinian people and Palestinian resistance. This presents a contradiction. If Zionists from the Comprador class to Julian Lisa and Mark Liebler condemn the Black Sovereign Movement for Aboriginal Palestinian solidarity, then what does that say about the voice proposal? Would the Palestinian people resist an advisory body established under the thumb of the Palestinian Authority that addresses the Knesset? What about constitutional recognition in the Huke Ha-Yesod? Perhaps a land acknowledgement to the indigenous Israelis of Jaffa, the traditional owners? It's insulting, isn't it? What horror would it be for the mask to come off on genocidal politicians, CEOs and Indigenous tokens this year after our sovereign political power was assimilated into the colonial constitution of Australia? It was always public information that the largest donors to the Yes campaign were companies such as BHP, Woodside Petroleum, and Rio Tinto. Three multinational corporations that actively destroy indigenous lands, waterways, and sacred sites. These companies have destroyed thousands of sacred sites. So why would they have had an interest in donating millions of dollars to this proposal? What reality would we live in amidst the construction of an advisory body coinciding with Albanese supporting war crimes and genocide in Palestine? Would the voice to Parliament stand alongside the Zionists, just as its most vocal supporters Marsha Langton and Nova Peres have? It could only seem that the voice would only further the interests of those who preach harm reduction but cause the most harm. Indeed, 12 months on from the voice, we can see that many of the exact things we warned about coming to fruition despite the referendum failure. We need only look at the South Australian voice to Parliament to see that any recommendations that the colonial occupation didn't agree with would have been ignored, as we ardently warned people about. Right now, the South Australian state government, as well as local city councils of the Adelaide area, are ignoring the South Australian state voice to Parliament calls to repatriate ancestral remains dug up as a part of the controversial River Lee housing development. The South Australian state voice advised against the River Lee housing development and the way it had fraudulently circumvented community consultation. The voice advised against the removal of ancestral remains from burial grounds in the area, and the voice gave recommendations to have those remains repatriated to their descendants so that they can be given the respect and courtesy of being reburied again. Yet, the South Australian government and local city councils have all ignored these warnings and recommendations. Not content with inaction on current issues in Kaurna country, the South Australian government and Melbourne City Council are also ignoring and silencing recommendations from the voice body in regards to the attacks on the annual Invasion Day rally planned for next year and the threats of criminalisation and arrest for organisers and participants of the largest annual protest day of action in the Aboriginal political calendar. In the state of Victoria, the regional dialogues rejected the voice to Parliament proposed long before the Uluru Statement from the Heart was even drafted. Likewise, they also rejected state-based treaties and truth commissions in favour of internationally recognised and scrutinised treaty and truth commission processes. Despite this very direct call from the broader Aboriginal community across the state, the Victorian state government ignored these dialogues and pursued their own state-level treaty and truth commission agendas, where the state colonial government wields all of the negotiating powers and has drafted all of the terms of reference and in such a way that it is designed to be a powerless and ineffective reform which will only give the illusion of progress while actually restricting real grassroots and community power. Anyone who believes the federal voice would not have been ignored as well is living in a fantasy not based on reality. That article that I just short article I just read out was one that was drafted by BPU Secretary Jasper, a local Wurundjeri traditional owner down here in Naarm. And he raises some great points. You know, if the voice to Parliament had have got up, if it had have been voted in, you know, what would it have looked like in a landscape where we have Israel and illegal colonial occupation committing genocide against indigenous Palestinians? You know, what would it have looked like when we know now, 2 years on, that Labor has fully supported this genocide? Labor has continued to support Israel in the way of, you know, providing them with all sorts of resources and logistical support. You know, where would the voice of Parliament have stood on all this stuff? Especially knowing that under the proposal, the voice to Parliament would have been a body that consisted of hand-picked blackfellas by the government who would have just rubber-stamped the government's agenda and the government's interests. You know, we know that because that was in the wording of the proposal. And we also know that we have Zionist blackfellas who are very aligned with this stuff. People like Marsha Langton, who goes on all expenses paid trips to Israel. People like Nova Peres, who also, again, goes on all expenses paid trips to Israel. You know, these two sorts of people who get on their social media and who blast black fellows who support Palestinians, who get on their social media and, you know, talk about the Palestinian resistance as being terrorists, who get on their social media and push PR for Israel, where would The Voice have stood in all this stuff? The Voice would have just been another body to condemn Palestinian resistance and to push pro-Israel propaganda. That's exactly what it would have been. And yet still, we have people 2 years on, you know, 2 years after everything's been happening in Palestine, we still have these rusted-on Labour hacks still going on about how great Labour is, still going on about how good The Voice would have been for blackfellas, still going on about how it was a progressive measure. You know, these people are living in an absolute delusion. That and they're racist. That's what it is at the end of the day. These people, these so-called progressives that, you know, lord stuff like The Voice to Parliament, at the end of the day, they are racist. They're, at you know, the best you can give them is to say that they're paternalistic racist. They're the covert racist, as opposed to the overt racist. You know, they're the racist that wants us assimilated instead of wiped out completely. But either way, you know, it's still the same outcome. When you assimilate us or wherever you exterminate us, it's still the exact same outcome. We cease to exist. And these paternalistic racists, they won't acknowledge that. They won't accept that. They live in this fantasy and this delusion. And it's absolutely disgusting that 2 years on, we still have to be talking about people like Mark Liebler and his role in The Voice to Parliament. Because people at the time were too idiotic to understand, you know, what Zionism was and that Israel was this horrific genocidal state. Never mind the fact that, you know, 2 years ago, Israel had still been a genocidal occupation for 73 years at the time. These people are racist, living with their head in their sand or their head up their rear end. You know, there's no other way to put it. It's absolutely disgusting that these people are out here under some false veneer of being progressive and of being, you know, working class and supporting the working class struggle and supporting black fellas and, you know, standing up against human rights violations and, you know, whatever other crap they try and tell you. You're listening to Kieran. This is Yilliman. That's enough for me for today. I'm going to finish up with a song. I'll be back next week. Next week, we're going to be talking a bit more about geopolitics again outside of the Australian context. A week or two ago, you know, we spoke about Iran and what was happening there. We're going to circle back to that, and we're going to talk a bit more about balkanization as well. In the meantime, stay tuned. Coming up next, we've got DJ Curly with Cultural Kinetics. You're listening to 3CR, 855 AM on your dial, 3cr.org.au, played online and via the playback service. You can also listen via podcast wherever you get your podcasts from. Until next week, have a good one.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.